Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Thursday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. Of course, you know the drill. We're recording on Wednesday morning. We're very lucky to be recording in Concord, New Hampshire, where the weather is perfect, the skies are clear, and all we're doing is focusing on the tragedy about to hit Florida. So I just want to let everyone know. And one more side note as I'm thinking about Florida, and that is, I think it's time that we reorient how we prioritize the U.S. budget. Rather than the Pentagon and the Defense Department, I think FEMA needs to be the most expansive part of our budget because that's going to be our future. Anyway, as you come to expect, we've been reading the poem America's a Gun for the last 2.5 or 3 months. And you know why? Because of Uvalde, because of Buffalo, because of Parkland. And we will continue to do this poem until November of 2022. Here we go, everyone. America is a Gun. England is a cup of tea, France a wheel of ripened brie. Greece, a short, squat, olive tree. America's a gun. Brazil is football on the sand. Argentina, Maradona's hand. Germany, an umpa band. America's a gun. Holland is a wooden shoe. Hungary, a goulash stew. Australia, a kangaroo. America's a gun. Japan is a thermal spring. Scotland is a highland fling. Oh, God, better to be anything than America as a gun. It's the poem by Brian Bilstone. You'll continue to hear this through and up to the election of November 2022. So I go to ProPublica a lot. I love what they do. I've met some of the best reporters and investigative reporters probably in the country at ProPublica. And then I saw this article and I'm like, oh my God, this is an article that reflects everything we talk about when we do our Rethink the Week with people like Stephen Pimper and Lincoln Mitchell. I need to have this conversation. The title of the piece at ProPublica was, How America's Democracy is Ripe to be Exploited. You think? Why are so many people now embracing demagogues? Barbara Walter is a political scientist and author of the book, How Civil Wars Start. She tells ProPublica that the vital signs of healthy democracy are in decline around the world, but frankly, especially, I think, in the United States. Eric Umansky is a deputy managing editor of ProPublica. He's the one that composed the piece at ProPublica. He oversees two Pulitzer Prize winning projects. Most recently, a series he edited on NYPD abuse of nuisance abatement laws won the Pulitzer Gold Medal for public service. Umansky oversaw much of the ProPublica's Trump administration coverage, lucky you, Eric, including Trump Inc., and we can go on and on and on. But obviously, you're on the front lines and you've been covering all this stuff. But in some ways, this is not a diversion for you, but maybe it's a encapsulation of everything that you cover and why ProPublica exists. So let me welcome you to the program.
Thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure. There is so much that you cover in this sort of cliff notes of Barbara Walter's book, How Civil War Starts. I just want to let you know that you open your piece, and this wasn't planned, but it opens this way. We talked to a guy from Sweden yesterday, okay? And why did we talk to the guy about Sweden? Because of what happened with the Swedish Democrats, which are not Democrats, but they're basically sort of fascists, they're authoritarians, and the rise of this party in Sweden. And I'm like, oh my God, Sweden too? You know, and of course we are following what's going on with, you know, Mussolini in a skirt in Italy. And I read your piece and it begins this way. Voters in Sweden this month gave a leading role to a far-right party with neo-Nazi roots. Italy is also on the cusp of putting a party in power, which they've done, that has fascist origins. And of course, in the United States, one party has increasingly embraced election denialism and attempted to undermine the legitimacy of the electoral process. So Eric, like you and I must be on the same script because everything that you were like writing about in that opening paragraph is literally stuff we've been covering in the last 48 to 72 hours. So we're noticing everything at the same time. And what is so shocking to me, Eric, is that we're not a standalone. This is almost like a pandemic. You know, We know that we suffered from COVID-19. Now we're suffering from democracy and, you know, in failure, and it is happening everywhere simultaneously. And I guess I need to ask the question, as you were interviewing this author, this political science professor, could she predict not only what was happening in the United States, but why is it happening all over the world?
She was very helpful. So she wrote this book that's sort of, unfortunately, one of the reads of the summer that, you know, I think just speaks to what's going on in the United States, because the book is How Civil Wars Start. she and other political scientists have essentially studied what are the commonalities that in countries that, you know, go from being stable and nonviolent to not stable and violent. What are the sort of trend lines and why does it happen? And, you know, it's I think easy for us to think in the United States that we're exceptional. And you can think of it not even in the sort of country on a hill sense. You know, we had this kind of black swan event, a, you know, TV reality star who, because of the unique, you know, history of the United States, was able to sort of, you know, touch the nerve of a large number of citizens. And because of the craziness of our electoral system, got elected with a minority of the vote. And, you know, even though he got less votes than Hillary Clinton. And so you can sort of think of it as like, it's a black swan event and it's crazy and it's, and what's happening? And you can just be very focused in the United States. What's happening in the United States that is, that makes us uniquely vulnerable to this? And there's a lot of utility in thinking through that, but there also are these commonalities. Again, as you know, you just noted, and as I noted, it's happening in other countries. So why is it happening in other countries? Barbara Walter, not related to Barbara Walters, the way. Yeah. But Barbara Walter has, and other political scientists essentially have identified a few different, what you could call them is risk factors, but also trends that are happening nowadays across the world. And it really kind of boils down to three things. One is the rural-urban divide. And the increasing sort of wealth and in some ways political, economic, and cultural capital that are being concentrated in urban centers. And so people feel kind of left behind with that. And that is hugely, I don't even know if exacerbated is the right word, because it's probably more accurately just simply driven by that in many of these countries, you have the historically dominant caste, whites, becoming, trending toward minority status, right? The U.S. is on a trend toward becoming a majority minority country. European countries are the same. And also the sort of fear of loss of status. It's not just about numbers, it's about status.
We're seeing a changing demographic. We're seeing the fact that we're now seeing that whites, especially in America, are becoming the minority party, not the majority party. And I don't mean party, but anyway, demographic. Think about this though. So even as they're losing their status, but they're also losing their economic stability simultaneously. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Because as we're seeing that grotesque, you know, gap between rich and poor, and then we see their status change, what I think the rich have been so clever at doing, Eric, is diverting attention away from what is actually causing the change in economic status and then pointing to the other, all right, and saying it's the other that's causing this, you know, demise in your economic stability. Because as long as we point to the other and they're actually seeing the other growing in size, they may not be growing in wealth, but they're definitely growing in size. It becomes easy then to feel threatened by them. And then you can sort of marshal their support as you begin looking at, you know, well, what do you attack? And that's sort of the title of the book, with civil wars, because what they've done is they've been manipulated.
And the third thing that it sort of supercharges this is social media, right? So it so happens that you have kind of economic globalization that is causing sort of concentrations of wealth and instability, as you're saying, and sort of questions of like, well, you know, are my kids going to have the same future? And again, you have kind of racial and ethnic fears. And then you have a sort of new medium that comes to rise that is unmediated by media. In other words, you know, Trump and whomever can speak, have been able to speak directly. to their supporters or potential supporters. And not just that, but it's a medium in which there's no regulation. You can, you know, there's all sorts of hate that can be spewed. So you have people's fear of becoming a minority, of being left behind. And you have a way to kind of reach these people and to sort of trigger their fears.
Right. But Eric, it's not just that it's unregulated, it's highly monetized. Mm-hmm. And it's that monetization that we need to fear. And as someone who used to write for the Boston Globe and someone who used to write for newspapers, you know, I used to get paid for what I did. And then it doesn't happen anymore because in a lot of ways, if you are a journalist, you're an unpaid journalist. But what's interesting about this new medium is that the new medium claims to spread information, claims to provide people with, you know, facts and understanding. But in fact, all it really does is provide, you know, certain very wealthy, concentrated companies to basically monetize whatever it turns out to be the most profitable. And I'm looking at your article and you write, and she sort of corrects you and she says, this new medium, she said, I would say it's stronger than that. It's not unregulated per se, but that it's being driven by algorithms that selectively push out the more extreme incendiary messages. And the reason why it is to their advantage to push out, this is now Arnie speaking,
yeah,
the more extreme incendiary messages is that they are so wickedly profitable. I mean, look at Donald Trump's rise during the campaign back in 2015. Donald Trump was profitable. He wasn't accurate. He wasn't truthful, but he was great for ratings. Talk to people at NBC. Talk to CNN, and they will tell you they accommodated Donald Trump to do things in a presidential campaign they had never, ever done before. Why? Because of ka-ching. So while it may be true, even with this sort of social media platform, it's been kind of a growing cancer within the generic media as well.
Yeah, I think that that's right. I think that that's right, which is that, you know, entertainment wins, noise wins, you know, and provide it, you know, demagogues provide a circus, you know, that's a feature, not a bug for
exactly.
them.
Exactly.
Right. And yeah. So, and no, I mean, and you see it in Italy and you see it in Sweden and you certainly see it in the United States.
You write that as we sort of, it says it comes down to three things and you mentioned three things, but she also talks about this and you go, she asked the following questions about why we see this sort of demise of democracy and this potential for civil wars. And she says, do you have constraints on the executive? Obviously the executive branch, Donald Trump being a perfect example of someone who apparently did not see anything in the way of constraints. Do you have the rule of law so that there's accountability? And do you have a level playing field so that there can really be popular participation? I mean, we are wickedly failing on all three. I mean, as I was reading your article, Eric, I was writing something to the effect of, I mean, how can we have a democracy when, you know, your access to the voting booth and how you vote is an accident of geography? So, you know, how you vote in Georgia is so different than how you vote in Texas, that it's so different from how you vote. And yet we're supposed to basically be, you know, choosing our U.S. senators that control all of us, control our members of Congress, control our executive branch. And yet how we get to access the vote is so different. And it's different not because it should be different, but the states basically control it. And geography is going to dictate that access.
Yeah. So I'm going to use a Yiddish term here, which is that our electoral system, when experts actually look at it and compare it to other democratic countries, our electoral system is completely verkackte. It is, you know, in ways that we both sort of recognize and actually in ways that are sort of less obvious because they just are, you know, part of the air that surrounds us. So ways that we recognize it but are powerfully undemocratic are the notion that, you know, the 500,000 or so residents of Wyoming have the same representation in the Senate that the 50x million residents of California do. Nobody would set up a system that, you know, was such if you're creating a true democracy nowadays. And, you know, you can go on down the list. I mean, redistricting, the notion that, as she points out, that the parties are in control, many, in many states, the parties are in control of, you know, drawing lines for districts. That is not how you would do things. But also some of the less recognized ways, I mean, it sort of is a spectrum, right? So one thing, even just until I read her book, that I was like, oh yeah, of course, that makes a tremendous amount of sense. She said, well, you know, we study these things, so we can tell you what essentially the best practices are, right? We give you the one page laminated sheet. You're starting a democracy. Here are like the five things that you need to do, right? Mm-hmm. And one is, it's a very kind of nuts and bolts thing, which is have a single national election administration that is nonpartisan, has guaranteed funding, right? That is, right? And you're like, oh yeah, so that everybody has the same access to the ballot and that there's one set of rules. And then you compare that, and she's like, that is in fact how it works in Canada, how it works in, you know, lots of places. And you then compare that to how it works in the United States, and your head kind of explodes. And you're like, oh yeah, that's the background of how it is. So one of the, you know, sort of explanations for how there's so much opportunity to screw around with things here.
And the Republicans have perfected the art, and they didn't do it overnight. They've been doing it slowly and steadily as they sort of move forward. And I mean, not that Democrats haven't sometimes been, you know, been handholding with them, but then you get to see things like, you know, well, you can't have racial gerrymandering, but you can't have partisan gerrymandering. I'm like, okay, so how do we tell whether it's partisan or racial? Because that you could claim, oh, I didn't look at the fact that that person was Black, but I did notice that they voted Democrat. Okay, so in the end, this was not a racial problem. This was a partisan issue. I mean, you look at the Supreme Court and you want to give them a knuckle sandwich when they said it was too complicated and they couldn't figure it out. And then you read a decision by the Supreme Court in North Carolina and they said, really? Watch us. We can figure it out. But how frightening it is to know that I have to wait 15 minutes to vote and that someone in another state is waiting online for 8 hours in 95 degree weather. And we think that we both have the same access to the voting booth.
And there are all sorts of components of that, that one of the things it does is it drives down participation in the political process, right? So it's not just about a kind of, you know, binary, do you have access to the ballot? It's that, well, if in my state, voting is not a holiday, if I can't get an easily an absentee ballot, if there's no place to vote near me, I'm just not going to do it, you know, and that falls disproportionately on, you know, communities of color who have to work, right, who have lower incomes and lower, you know, disposable income, and that then decreases political power. So it is a self-replicating dynamic.
Well, and it's intentional. I mean, let's be honest, it's intentional. There was another thing that she writes in this book, and I had never heard this term before, and I wanted you to sort of flesh it out. She writes about a concept called ethnic entrepreneurs. Ooh, I was like, what the hell is that? But when it's explained, it's like, bingo. So can you explain what she means by ethnic entrepreneurs? Because I think it's a very clever way of describing what we're seeing.
So again, she's talking about political scientists studying sort of countries that descend into, you know, political or chaos and actual chaos and violence. And looking at, you know, the sort of commonality. So one of the commonalities that she finds is there's often a player who comes to the scene called, that she labels, an ethnic entrepreneur. She actually uses the example of Slobodan Milosevic in Serbia in the early 1990s, who was like a diehard communist party apparatchik who was on the cusp of losing power. Nobody liked the communists. And he sort of said, wait a second, there are a lot of Serbs. They're constantly worried about getting screwed over by Croatia. Now that the world is changing, everything has shifted, they're probably particularly anxious about getting screwed over by Croats and Bosnians. I am going to begin to appeal to their sense of fear, just as a purely calculated thing and a kind of animal instinct. You know, I am going to appeal to their sense of fear. Fear can often win, particularly when there's a lot of uncertainty in the world. Right. And yes, that is exactly the dynamic. When you sort of think of it in that way, you're like, oh, I know another ethnic entrepreneur, right?
Exactly.
And he got into the White House.
Exactly. The idea of ethnic entrepreneur, it blew my mind because it was such a great description because, you know, it's a marketing opportunity. You know, it's like Milosevic going, I'm a Serb too. Oh, how perfect, you know? And there's, again, it's creating a base and feeding it a set of lies and working on their fear that necessarily has no relationship to their being Serbs, but he connects the dots. See, that's the most important thing. Everyone may have fear. Everyone may be angry about what's happened to their economy. Everyone may be ticked off about losing a job. But then the problem is that the ethnic entrepreneur says, let me tell you what we have in common, okay? And it has probably nothing to do with why they lost their job, but then he uses that commonality to point a finger of blame. And I think that's what is so, so terrifying.
And it's an explanation too.
Yes.
It's a powerful explanation. And by the way, it becomes a reality when, well, I'm not really a Serb nationalist. If these sort of stews are being, you know, stirred up, well, then, you know, Croats are actually increasingly angry and so are Serbs. And it begins to have its own momentum.
I didn't realize I was describing, it wasn't necessarily an ethnic entrepreneur, but I've told this story many times and I'm going to sort of end with this, Eric. I was running for Congress and it was 1996 and I walk into a room and the room is packed with a group of men who used to work in the paper mills. They were absolutely furious with me. So I walked into a very hostile setting and the first guy walks up to me and goes, you know, Arnie Arneson, we hate you. And I looked at him and I said, really, have we met? And then it turned out that the reason why they hated me was that I was, I did not support the Welfare Reform Act. And they looked at me and they said, we hate welfare people. You don't get it, Arnie. We work 50 and 60 hours a week and we can't go to a doctor when we're sick. We work 50, 60 hours a week and we don't get Section 8 housing. We work 50, 60 and 70 hours a week and no one provides us. And he went to this whole laundry list and he said, those welfare people get it and we do not. And I listened to him and I said, boy, you know, I'd be pissed off too. If I was working all those hours and couldn't go to a doctor and working all those hours and running out of money to buy food, I'd be pissed off too. But why do you think taking it away from those welfare women, as you call them, will get it for you? And they didn't answer. And I said, you know what I'm hearing from you? It's not that there's something wrong with welfare, Eric. I said, what I'm hearing from you is that there's something wrong with work. Because when you can work 70 hours and can't afford to go to a doctor, there's something wrong with work. But this is a form of entrepreneurism, because what they made sure is that you blamed welfare. You blamed the other. You pictured someone driving a pink Cadillac going to collect a welfare check. It usually was a black woman. And so therefore it was so easy to hate them and to see what they got and what you didn't have and somehow think that they were taking from you, which in effect, you weren't getting paid for what you did, you know? And that story has been going on forever and ever. It isn't necessarily an ethnic entrepreneur, but it's something that is very cleverly done to create a divide. And what they're pointing to as the problem isn't the problem, but then it directs it away from where the problem actually exists. I have to read this book, I think, I'm not sure I want to, about why, you know, the to some extent, it's not just the United States that is ripe for civil war. It is everywhere around the world. And if we see a spreading pandemic, it's not just COVID-19, it is this. Now the question is, to be aware of this is to be forewarned. The question is, can we do this? Eric Yamansky, thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate you having me on.
It's a deal. This is the Thursday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson, producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. All right, stick around, everyone.
When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933. When your eyes are open, when you know the history. When your parents lived through things that looked so much like this.
All the indications impossible to miss when you've sought for your whole life to make the earth a better place. And you once again see the rising of the master race when you know that they are coming, when they announced it in advance. When you know for many people this will be their last chance, then you may ask the question, what can one person do when the time to act is now? And now it's up to you. When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933, when indefinite detention is the new reality for so many children to whom you did not give birth, when you see they're just as precious as every other child on earth, when they're opening the camps not used since the war, where families were imprisoned decades before, when Kristallnacht is coming, they announced it on the news, when the writing's on the wall, when you can see the fuse, then you may ask the question, what can one person do when the time to act is now? And now it's up to you.
Welcome back to the Thursday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson, our producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. We continue to record on Wednesday morning. Well, we are up to episode 9 of Race Class. We have been discussing critical race theory and the whole sort of history of racism in America with Professor Jonathan Feingold since January of 2022. We'll continue to do this through December of 2022, unless I can convince him to do it for another year. But let me remind you why we're doing this. Legislation restricting the teaching of race and racism in public schools and government entities has spread across the country. In an effort to respond, Boston University Law Professor Jonathan Feingold and Arnie Arneson, myself, on WNHN are offering Race Class, a once-a-month course conversation where listeners can hear what it's like to approach race and racism from a place of curiosity and history rather than fear and anxiety. You can grab Race Class the last Thursday of every month. It's heard at 12:30 on the dial in Concord, New Hampshire, also streaming live. It is also available by podcast. It is separately podcast as Race Class. It also goes up on AudioPort. But I just want to remind everyone that in describing the foundational purpose of Race Class, Arneson and Feingold note, quote, "We know race matters. Part of this project is to make sense of what that means." So let me welcome back to the program, Jonathan Feingold. God, episode 9. We've been doing this for a while, Jonathan. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Arnie. As always, it's nice to be here. After a summer when we were doubling up over the past 3 months, it felt like a long time in between visits. And so I'm really glad to be back. Yeah, to kick things off today, I want to just refer back to the past 3 months where we had 6 episodes, which turned into what I thought was a really nice little mini series on affirmative action. And the upshot, I think, that one could fairly draw is that if the goal in university admissions is a fair, individualized, and merit-based process, then that just means you have to take into account all relevant factors. Right. One highly relevant factor is race. Whether or not we want it to, race remains a central organizing force in America that shapes almost every, if not every, aspect of our public and private lives. And so what that means is that if we go, quote unquote, colorblind, if we don't allow ourselves to see race, if we don't allow ourselves to see racial inequality, then that guarantees us a system that rewards those with the most inherited racial advantage at the expense of everyone else and at the expense of even, you know, just basic commitments to admitting people on, but you know, just based on who has the most academic talent and potential. And I say that in part because one of the reasons we had that miniseries is because in almost exactly a month, the Supreme Court will hear oral argument in 2 cases that challenge and will likely be the end of affirmative action in higher education. Both Harvard and UNC, we've talked about at relative length, are defending their right to consider an applicant's racial identity. And we know where this case is going to land, maybe not precisely how, but I'm really confident about this, in part because I think we know the court at this point. The Supreme Court is going to side with anti-affirmative action activists who have literally, and I don't mean literally in the figurative sense, but I mean literally, bankrolled decades of litigation designed to roll back civil rights remedies like affirmative action in order to stymie civil rights. it's not just what the Supreme Court's going to do. It's the rationale that they are going to offer. The Supreme Court will tell us that the decision is necessary in order to be faithful to the 14th Amendment, Brown v. Board of Education, and Title VI, federal anti-discrimination law that was part of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. And so our inquiry for today, you know, especially with, I imagine you have many listeners who have Dobbs in the back of their mind or in the forefront of their mind.
Forefront.
Understand it as a quite lawless opinion that played quite cavalierly with facts and history in order to dispense with settled law and, you know, just produce an ideologically motivated result. But so with that in the back of our minds, where does the Supreme Court decision or the affirmative action decision that I just previewed, where does it stack up? Is it more activist than Dobbs? Is it less activist than Dobbs? Is it the same? And so that's our inquiry today.
You're asking the question in relationship to Dobbs. I looked at your outline and it looks like it's been a pattern in practice with this court. This is not a one-off, because if you actually go look at what the court has done, you know, for centuries, their tendency is to do exactly what you are predicting they will do with affirmative action.
And so I asked the question and I posed the sort of juxtaposition with Dobbs for a couple reasons.
Okay.
One is that when Dobbs came down, the general narrative was this is a court that is lawless. This is a court that is not faithful to the Constitution. It's a court that is faithful to a very extremist, religiously inflected project. And so the question, and I don't think the public, I don't think the media will read the affirmative action decision. I don't think they will talk about it in the same way. And I think descriptively, that's misguided, because this decision, this affirmative action decision coming down the line, assuming that I'm not wrong, I would gladly be wrong about what's coming, it is going to, in a sense, be the penultimate capstone, because I think something is coming next after this, to about 150 years of what I am referring to as an activist Supreme Court, in the sense of a Supreme Court that has been unfaithful to the Constitution. And I really mean the Constitution born out of the Civil War and hostile to racial justice. And that's, you know, maybe a big claim, but I think there's quite a evidentiary basis to it. For anyone who wants to hear the case that I'm making in, 25,000 words, Brandon Hasbrook, who's a law professor, wrote an incredible article published by the Boston University Law Review called The Anti-Racist Constitution, in which he excavates a history that reminds us that the problem today, when it comes to realizing it, reckoning with our history, and actually remedying racial inequality, the problem isn't the Constitution. The Constitution, if we were faithful to it, if we were faithful to its original public meaning, were we all actually originalists, the Constitution would invite, if not compel us, to engage in a whole range of what we might consider quite radical anti-racist remedies. So, you know, with that, let's do some time traveling.
I want to do some time traveling, because when I was reading about the 1883 civil rights cases where SCOTUS strikes down an anti-discrimination law, I read the paragraph that you sent me and I started to scream, because I could just see how they were sort of warping their logic to sort of justify their actions. But it is just, they were so malleable and so not consistent with what I think you were just saying about the Constitution.
I think one can fairly say that there have been maybe three moments in our country's history in which we have aspired, through laws that we've passed or constitutional amendments that we've adopted, that we've aspired for something that you might call radical democracy. Right. Like just the notion that we actually want to live up to everything that we say about ourselves. And the first moment, and maybe the first moment is sort of a series of moments, but I will encapsulate it in the ratification of the 14th Amendment.
Okay.
And so this is 1868, a few years after the Civil War has ended, in which the North has ostensibly won, though now we have to ask, you know, who actually won. And in 1872, so just a few years later, in the Slaughterhouse cases, which is notorious for a reason that we'll get to in a little bit, the Supreme Court, so, you know, a court that's privy to the Civil War, privy to the 14th Amendment in ways that none of us are, at least that court suggests that no one can fail to be impressed with the one pervading purpose found in them all. That is all of the Civil War amendments, the 13th, 14th, and 15th, lying at the foundation of each, and without which none of them would have been even suggested. Mm-hmm. We mean the freedom of the slave race, the security and firm establishment of that freedom, and the protection of the newly made freemen and citizen from the oppression of those who had formerly exercised unlimited dominion over them. That strikes me as a bold, ambitious constitutional amendment that is meant to transform the Constitution. Yes. It's meant to give us a document that we did not have before, for reasons that the late Thurgood Marshall invoked when he stated at his bicentennial address in 1987 that the Constitution did not survive the Civil War. The Union did, but the Constitution did not, because the Civil War gave us a new Constitution, one that was committed to, you know, what we might think of as radical democracy.
Right.
We know, though, that that promise was short-lived. And so let me jump now to our second moment of, you know, what we might think of as radical democracy. And that is Brown v. Board of Education. Footnote, a lot of ways that one can critique Brown as not actually going far enough, not as misidentifying a symptom of white supremacy for the disease itself. Nonetheless, it is a, you know, radical moment that strikes down at a pillar of Jim Crow and chops away at Plessy. It is only made possible by mass mobilization, decades of litigation, and a geopolitical context that, you know, in which, as individuals like Derrick Bell have identified, made segregation no longer sustainable for, you know, America's white ruling class for various reasons. So that's the second moment. And the third is the Civil Rights Act of 1964. There's, you know, obviously one could name other moments, but these are three that are key for reasons that we've said and that I'll say again. Congress passes the Civil Rights Act, contains a number of provisions, including a public accommodations law that prevents theaters, restaurants, train stations from discriminating on the basis of race. And in a second, we'll ask why we needed to do that. And it has a provision known as Title VI that prohibits discrimination on the basis of race by entities that receive federal financial assistance. Right. So why did we need the Civil Rights Act? Why do we need all these provisions? Well, with respect to Title VI, part of the reason was that Congress needed a way to enforce Brown's mandate to desegregate. Because 10 years after Brown v. Board, the South, in explicit ways, through raising arms and, you know, in every other measure, said no. Essentially, you know, said no. Sorry, Supreme Court, don't care. Don't like the opinion, you're illegitimate. We're not moving. And so Congress and the courts begin to reassert authority. Civil Rights Act's one way to do it. Civil Rights Act barely passed. Yeah. It survived the longest filibuster in Senate history. I think 75 days or so when you actually still had to talk to filibuster. At the time, I believe it was only the fifth civil rights law ever passed by Congress. Only after, you know, it survived filibusters that today you don't even like have discussion about. So little history, three moments that I think you can fairly identify as attempts by this country to codify laws that are designed to bring us closer to our highest aspirations of a radically democratic multiracial union. Why do I name those three, that constitutional amendment, that Supreme Court decision, and that federal law? Because when the Supreme Court says, Harvard, you may not consider race to maintain an integrated campus. When it says UNC, you may not consider race to overcome your ongoing and deep-seated legacy of racial exclusion, the Supreme Court is going to point to those three moments and say that those are the reasons why we cannot engage in what is in every respect just a modest manifestation of what everyone was asking for in the summer of 2020. How can we, what is the anti-racist policy? What can we do to reckon with this reality? The Supreme Court is going to step in and say, so you can't do it. And it's going to point to the most, you know, our most radical aspirations. I'm going to pause. I'd love for you to jump in and hear any reactions.
They're going to use these radical aspirations as cover for why they're going to take away from UNC and Harvard the ability to embrace affirmative action that recognizes race. So they're going, I mean, it's almost, I can't use the term on, but it's a mind F, because it's like what you think would be the encouragement of affirmative action. Now they're using those same positions to say, no, it undermines affirmative action. Therefore, affirmative action is basically, are they going to find it unconstitutional because of these three things that you just pointed out? Is they going to sort of go that far to say that that you can consider it because it violates the 14th Amendment?
Yes, the Supreme Court is going to say that what UNC is doing is unconstitutional because of the 14th Amendment. The Supreme Court will say what Harvard is doing is unlawful because of Title VI, because Harvard is a private entity, not a public university. And so the Supreme Court is going, and we don't have time to talk about the full, like the past 70 years and 50 years of a more piecemeal strategy to get to this point and to do so in a way where, again, I do not think that most of the public or the media will experience this decision in the same way that they did Dobbs, as a moment of lawless infidelity to the Constitution, infidelity to the Constitution that is really just meant to further an anti-democratic and anti-civil rights agenda. But so let me just, you know, give us a few more sort of pieces that we can play around with. So I'm making a, you know, pretty bold claim that the Supreme Court has been unfaithful to the Constitution, particularly with respect to the 14th Amendment and also the 13th and 15th Amendment, but laws that were part of the most racially progressive, radical moment in our history. And the Supreme Court does this in three different ways. One is by striking down racially progressive laws. You referenced this before. We'll name it in a second. The second is by neutralizing or diffusing laws that are designed to stop racism writ large by saying, like, making them, you know, inert. But the third, and this is what we're going to see in the affirmative action case, is actually co-optation of these radically progressive laws for radically regressive purposes. Because what the Supreme Court is going to say is that it's not just that an institution might have a mandate to reckon with the history of racism. The Supreme Court is saying it's impermissible to. And so here, so let's just, you know, we'll walk through some examples. So what's an example of the Supreme Court striking down a law designed to advance democracy and racial justice?
Let me just say something. This question blew my mind. Because when I watched the mental gymnastics of what they went through to strike down an anti-discrimination law, I was both shocked, But at the same time, as I was reading it, I could see how it sort of forecasted exactly what the Supreme Court would be doing, as you just described, even with affirmative action, because it lays a foundation for how they sort of manipulate what they ultimately want, which is an outcome that you and I know, frankly, is not what the fathers envisioned, or frankly, what the Civil War envisioned. You know, if you're going to free people, then recognize what does freedom mean?
And, you know, a different sort of question is, like, either thinking about sort of that Reconstruction period after the Civil War or post-Brown, is the remedy to Brown, or the remedy to the harm that is underlying Brown, the constitutional violation that is giving rise to Brown, is the remedy just eliminating all of the formal policies that said, if you are not white, you might go here? Like, the question is, like, have we achieved what Brown demands just by formally opening the schoolhouse door?
Right.
And we know that never has it been the case where just formally opening the schoolhouse door, or by law making it unlawful to enslave by prohibiting slavery as a matter of law, we know that's never been enough, because the formal policy was, you know, it was part of the infrastructure that propped up a broader system. It wasn't the infrastructure. In 1875, you know, decade after the Civil War, Congress is trying to figure out how to actually realize this promise of a union in which everyone has some semblance of, you know, equal citizenship. And I'm using citizenship not in a technical term, but just like equal membership of the society. And Congress recognizes that one of the barriers to full citizenship is all of the private discrimination that non-white people, Black people, among others, face. And so Congress passes the first federal anti-discrimination law that today we would just take for granted. And the Supreme Court strikes it down. The Supreme Court strikes it down on the basis that Congress lacked the authority pursuant to either the 14th Amendment or 13th Amendment to regulate, quote unquote, private conduct. Yeah, go ahead.
Is there rationale? I literally, this paragraph screams at me, and I just want to read it because I think it's too important. When a man has emerged from slavery and by the aid of beneficent legislation has shaken off the inseparable commitments of that state, there must be some stage in that progress of his elevation when he takes the rank of a mere citizen and ceases to be the special favorite of the laws. And when his rights as a citizen or a man are to be protected in the ordinary modes by which other men's rights are protected, there are thousands, this is the amazing gymnastics. There are thousands of free colored people in this country before the abolition of slavery, enjoying all the essential rights of life, liberty, and property, the same as white citizens. Yet no one at that time thought it was any invasion of their personal status as free men, because they were not admitted to all the privileges enjoyed by white citizens, or because they were subjected to discriminations in the enjoyment of accommodations and inns, public conveyances, and places of amusement. Mere discriminations on account of race or color were not regarded as badges of slavery. Oh my God, Jonathan, I read that paragraph and I'm like, are you kidding me? This is how they were able to strike down that anti-discrimination law. Just because we don't let them into a hotel or a motel or to a restaurant, you know, before we abolished slavery, and no one complained about that, that had nothing to do with slavery, i.e. being Black, i.e. being discriminated. Therefore, we don't have to protect, you know, we don't have to protect these individuals. And this anti-discrimination law, in fact, is false or unconstitutional.
I want to just tease out a couple threads from this quote, because this quote is from a Supreme Court decision that was issued in 1883, so less than two decades after the Civil War. But we can still hear arguments that were here in arguments that are made today against, for example, affirmative action. Mm-hmm. So the claim in this context that anti-discrimination law was going to render African-Americans the quote-unquote special favorite of the laws, that is the same argument we hear today against affirmative. It is, you know, almost identical. And then, and also how legislation that is designed to ensure the equality of one is then just articulated or rearticulated as an invasion of the rights of others.
Right.
And so we see this in like all over the civil rights context, whether it's about the rights of trans people, whether it's about the rights of women, whether it's about the people of color, though, like laws that are designed to prevent discrimination against groups that have faced historical discrimination in this country are re-articulated as an invasion of other rights. Now, often in sort of the rhetoric of religious freedom or religious liberty. But this is a through line that we have been with for a really, really long time. And so we are, we're almost out of time. So let me just quickly identify an example of the Supreme Court neutralizing laws that are designed to, you know, realize radical democracy. One example is the slaughterhouse cases, which I pulled a quote from before. And that was a decision in which the Supreme Court effectively neutralized the Privileges or Immunities Clause in the 14th Amendment. My sense is that almost no Americans have ever even heard of the Privileges or Immunities Clause. From the perspective of the folks on the ground at the time, that was the clause, arguably, that was the one that was designed to be the most forceful, the most potent to ensure an actual transition from a state of formal racial hierarchy to one of equal citizenship. And with the stroke of an ink dotted pen, the Supreme Court, in the most of anti-democratic ways, intervened and has essentially written the Privileges or Immunities Clause out of the Constitution.
Oh my God. Oh, we got to go. I'm telling you, reading that 1883 case, I was just screaming, going, but you're absolutely right. I'm reading these things going, it sounds like what this court is saying today. And we're talking the late 1880s. And yet I'm hearing a court in 2022 basically mirroring those same words. This is Race Class, Episode 9 with Jonathan Feingold. Again, I want to remind you, we do this every month. And one of the reasons we're doing this is that we know race matters. And part of the reason for Race Class is to make sense of what that means. Thank you so much for joining me, Jonathan Feingold. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Arnie.
This is The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. We will schmooze tomorrow, everyone. Ciao.